Hello, and thank you for joining today's call. I'm Jim Doyle with Business Forward. We're pleased to have you, Doug Rahn, with us today. I'll be moderating our conversation. Currently, all lines are in listen-only mode. Doug Rahn is a senior fellow and director of the Technology and Innovation Initiative at the Federation of American Scientists and the co-founder of Boundless, a technology company that empowers families to navigate the immigration system more confidently, rapidly, and affordably. Doug also served in the Obama White House for 6 years with a portfolio spanning inclusive high-growth entrepreneurship, access to capital, clean energy innovation, commercialization of federally funded research, and high-skilled immigration. We've asked Doug to talk about the Department of Homeland Security's public charge rule, which will go into effect next week. But before we get started, I need to cover a few housekeeping items. First, you can participate in two ways. You can email your question to us at info@businessfwd.org, and we'll read aloud. Please note the name of your business and where you live and your message. Again, that's info@businessfwd.org. Or you can also press 1 on your dial pad at any time to be entered into the queue to ask your question live. We'll get to as many questions as we can. Please note that this call is on the record and there may be reporters present. Doug, thank you for joining us. Please go ahead.
Thanks, Jim. Can you hear me okay?
Perfect.
Great. All right. Well, thanks again to Business Forward and for all of you joining today. I'll try to be brief so we can have as much time as possible for Q&A. But as Jim said, currently I'm the co-founder of a technology company called Boundless, which you could almost think of as TurboTax for immigration, where we are enabling and empowering immigrants and their families to apply for green cards and for U.S. citizenship more affordably, including high-quality legal services and access to an independent attorney. So we are spearheading an amicus brief in opposition to the upcoming DHS public charge rule. But before I get into the details of that, let me give you a little bit more background. It's been pretty clear really since the beginning of the Trump administration that that the administration's most ambitious plan to restrict and curtail legal immigration was going to be on the basis of something called the public charge grounds, which has been around really since Ellis Island days and was originally intended to bar immigrants who were indigent, likely to end up on the streets, and it's evolved over time. But the administration's trying to take a much more expansive view of this provision in our immigration laws than has ever been done before. So when the administration, when DHS first proposed to change the public charge standards in the fall of last year, they did it through a regulation. So this is an executive action led by the Department of Homeland Security to change federal regulations to dramatically alter how immigration officers will test whether somebody is, quote, likely to become a public charge, unquote. This proposed rule was very alarming. You've probably seen various reporting about it. Most of the reporting focuses on the fact that it would penalize immigrants who use social safety net programs by denying them green cards and other visas. That's actually only part of the story, and actually arguably the less important part. The major impact this rule will have is to make it impossible for a very large number of immigrants who never use social safety net programs from remaining or coming to the United States, which I'll explain a little bit later. So we organized a letter on behalf of what ultimately was over 120 business leaders from all over the country opposing this regulation on the primary grounds that it is bad for business. So let me explain why we believe it would be bad for business by getting a little bit into the weeds, but not too far, on what the public charge rule is. So for the past more than two decades, this is how immigration has worked. If you want to get a green card, you either need a family member in the U.S. to sponsor you, or you need an employer in the U.S. to sponsor you. There's a couple other routes. there's, you know, humanitarian green cards like for asylees and refugees. Set those aside. Those are not implicated by this rule. This rule really affects people who are sponsored by family members or U.S. companies. Now, Congress ordained, again, about 20 years ago, that if you are sponsoring someone to come to the United States for permanent residency, for a green card, so here to stay and ultimately become a citizen, the first thing you need to do is guarantee to the government satisfaction that you as the sponsor are going to make sure that this immigrant stays well above the poverty line for as long as they are a permanent resident. And the technical term for this document is an affidavit of support. Is a legally binding contract between the sponsor and the U.S. government saying, you know, because it's in the national interest that immigrants don't, you know, make undue use of the welfare system, that I, the sponsor, will provide for this individual financially and will make sure they never get below 125% of the federal poverty guidelines. That bright line rule, that 125% rule, is in federal law ordained by Congress. And that's been basically all you needed to do to guarantee to the government satisfaction that the immigrant was not going to, quote unquote, become a public charge. Now, there was a footnote where, you know, you'd be considered likely to become a public charge if you were likely to become primarily dependent on the government for survival. So if you used And that basically meant cash assistance, like, you know, temporary assistance for needy families, also known as welfare, Social Security, SSI, disability benefits, or long-term institutionalization. This affected almost nobody because, you might not know it from the headlines, but the vast majority of immigrants who don't have green cards yet are not eligible for any kind of federal assistance. So many of you who've gone through this process may remember, oh yeah, I filled out that form to sponsor, you know, a family member or maybe even an employee, and that's all you really needed to do. And that was in keeping with 100 years of precedent, where really the goal of that public charge statute is to prevent people who truly can't support themselves in any way from being a burden on society. So here's what the public charge rule would do. And by the way, the proposed rule came out last year. The final rule came out in August of this year. It's set to go into effect on Tuesday of next week, unless it is blocked by a federal judge in the meantime. And there are 9 lawsuits seeking to tear down this rule on the grounds that it's on several different grounds that it's lawless. But what would it do? Well, fundamentally, it would create a massively complex new set of criteria by which would-be immigrants would be judged likely to become a public charge. And they've basically decided, well, let's identify 20 different criteria that have really never been operative before in this way, and use those as a proxy for somebody likely to become a public charge. And they're redefining public charges. Anybody who touches an expanded set of public benefits for 12 out of 36 months at any point in the future. But remember, someone's actual use of public benefits is really a red herring here, because most immigrants aren't eligible for public benefits. So what this rule really does is to say, okay, an immigration officer is going to look at your green card application, and even if you have that affidavit of support from your sponsor, that's not going to be enough. The immigration officer is going to look at 20 different factors and score you, positive column, negative column. If you're working age, that's positive. If you have a medical condition, a chronic medical condition, that's negative. If your English isn't perfect, that's negative. If your family is rather large, that's a negative. If you don't have verifiable occupational certifications, that's a negative. If you have any financial liabilities, including credit card debt or a mortgage, or, you know, who among us doesn't have financial liabilities, that's a negative. Perhaps most significantly, if your income is not greater than 250% of the poverty guidelines, so that's 2.5 times the federal poverty guidelines, which, for reference, is about $73,000 for a family of 5, then that's going to count against you as well. So what this rule effectively does is create a whole new set of hurdles for anyone who wants to become a permanent resident and ultimately a citizen in the United States. And it's basically a test of wealth, a test of health, a test of English. It's effectively a complex new set of criteria that Congress never authorized, that this administration would love for Congress to authorize, but in the absence of Congress acting, they're doing what one of their top officials just described recently as a workaround to try to conform the immigration system to their vision, which, you know, it's no secret that they prefer immigrants from certain countries and from certain wealth brackets. So the main point I want to get across is that, you know, despite what you've read, this is not primarily a rule that will penalize poor people and penalize people for using public benefits, although it would do that. Its primary effect is going to be to dramatically constrain immigration to this country, and to basically, for the first time in our history, say you have to already have been wealthy and successful and healthy before we'll even let you in. So that's how the rule would work. Oh, and by the way, it's not just that there's going to be this hard to predict, highly subjective 20-factor test. There's a whole new set of evidentiary criteria that applicants are going to need to submit, a whole new 15-page form, basically a whole bunch of new red tape. So you may be asking, okay, well, how is my business going to be affected by this? And I would say there's four reasons for businesses to, I think, really strongly oppose the public charge rule, which happen to be the four things that we had businesses sign up to highlight in our public comment last year, and happen to be the same things that we're going to be highlighting in an amicus brief, which I'll talk about in a second. But basically, the four reasons are: number one, if this public charge rule goes into effect, it's going to drastically reduce the talent pool available to U.S. companies, both in the obvious way, like you want to hire somebody and, you know, even though they're making a perfectly respectable white-collar salary, it's not quite high enough to pass this hurdle. Or maybe they have a chronic health condition, or maybe they have a mortgage that some immigration officer thinks is too high. There's lots of reasons that someone could be denied that are brand new, totally novel, and that make the whole process far more uncertain. But it's not just your employees who are foreign nationals that are at risk. It's very common for U.S. citizens to marry foreign nationals, to have children with foreign nationals. You probably, either have employees or will in the future whose close family members happen to be born elsewhere. And guess what? If they want to stay together with their spouses or children or their parents, that's going to be much more difficult under this rule. And by the way, the largest category of immigration to this country in terms of permanent residence is spouses of U.S. citizens. This is going to adversely affect recruitment and retention, not just of people coming here from another country, but also U.S. citizens who have close ties to foreign-born family members. The second reason this is bad for business, I mentioned earlier, is this immense new paperwork burden. There's a new 15-page form. There's a whole bunch of new evidence people have to provide in terms of credit score and employment history and assets and liabilities and English proficiency and a whole raft of things that were never necessary before. By the way, the DHS only just released this form this week, giving the public and lawyers and even their own employees, immigration officers, almost no time to prepare. So if this does go into effect next week, it's going to be chaos. It's going to cost thousands of extra dollars for each employee to make it through this process. Third reason, you're all business owners. I too am a business owner and entrepreneur. The name of the game is, if it's profitable, you do it. If the benefits outweigh the costs, this rule completely flouts the basic principle of federal rulemaking, which is it dramatically understates the costs to society and dramatically overstates the benefits, which we've gone into in more detail in other documents. But take it from me. This regulation completely ignores the fact that immigrants, the best data shows that immigrants across the socioeconomic spectrum pay more in taxes than they take out in public benefits. And that's just the direct effects. Indirectly, they provide immense economic benefits to our country in general. The fourth thing, which I think is particularly offensive to business owners, is that this rule is contrary to American values. Andrew Carnegie came to this country with almost nothing and worked his way to become a captain of industry. So did many of the technology entrepreneurs that are household names. So did many CEOs who are now household names. Never in our history have we imposed a wealth test on people who want to start a new life in America. We have a merit-based system in the traditional sense that you come here to take advantage of new opportunities and show what you can do, and you're not constrained by your circumstances of birth in your home country. So that's just a quick overview of what this rule would do, why it's bad for business, particularly smaller businesses who don't have a legion of lawyers who can navigate this. Now, what you can do is very simple. You could sign on to an amicus brief that Boundless is spearheading, and that we will be filing wherever there is a lawsuit on appeal in federal circuit court in the month ahead. Like I said, there are 9 lawsuits being filed by over a dozen attorneys general from many different states, a bunch of nonprofit groups. Boundless is not party to any of these lawsuits, nor am I encouraging you to be party to any of these lawsuits. What we can do, as businesses have done in the past, for example, with the successful litigation to keep DACA from falling apart and being rescinded by this administration, like the business community has done by filing amicus briefs against the travel ban earlier in this administration, there is a really important point here to be made that I don't think is adequately raised in a lot of the litigation so far, which is that this rule is bad for business and this rule is bad for American economic growth and innovation. And who better to make that point than American business leaders? So all you have to do is just sign a form that Business Forward has sent around and will reiterate, making a provisional commitment to sign an amicus brief that will cover the points I just made, those 4 points. We will very soon, probably as early as next week, have the full amicus brief ready for you to review. And we will be filing that amicus brief, again, as soon as any of these lawsuits make it past the district court level, which is where they are currently, and make it to the appeals court level. So I've said my piece for now. I hope this was not too wonky and made good sense. And at this point, I'd love to turn it back over to Jim and open it up to questions.
Thank you very much, Doug. We appreciate it. Again, if we'll open up for questions, you can email your questions to us at info@businessfwd.org, or you can press 1 on your dial pad, and you can ask your questions live. Doug, I'd like to start with a broad question. You mentioned that there's been no congressional authorization of these kind of steps. Why hasn't there been, maybe not in this Congress, but in the previous Congress, why aren't they getting, why didn't Congress help the Trump administration with this?
Well, I mean, I think the Trump administration has been unable to get Congress to enact any of its ideas on immigration changes, and this is no exception. I mean, frankly, most members of Congress, including Democrats and Republicans, are not in favor of reducing legal immigration. That's actually a point of bipartisan agreement. But the Trump administration's full of hardliners, and it's kind of the dream of this nativist movement to constrain not only unlawful entry into this country, but legal immigration as well. I mean, I'm not, the president has made his own comments about his preference for immigrants from Norway over other countries that he deemed less valuable. And they, the public charge rule is probably the biggest executive action that they are pursuing to change the legal immigration system. But there's dozens of others that I haven't mentioned that altogether create what many call an invisible wall restricting legal immigration. I should have told you this stat before too. Boundless has lots of very detailed confidential information about people applying for green cards for their spouses, and in particular. And by our estimate, if you look at how many of these people just clear the income threshold I mentioned earlier, we could be talking about separating half of the married couples who apply for green cards each year. Nearly 200,000 foreign-born spouses of U.S. citizens, U.S. citizens and permanent residents, unable to remain in the United States or come to the United States and live together for the long haul. So this is a big deal. This the president has proposed legislation to cut that would effectively cut legal immigration in half. It went nowhere. This is, in their view, the next best thing that they think they can do without Congress.
We have a number of questions that just got sent in. There's one that it's a long question, but I think it's a very good one, and I'm going to read it in its entirety. It's from Vlandi Manohar from Haddon, Connecticut, of Aware Recovery Care. He's a medical director. He says, I am not sure what will be different. I remember signing documents when I sponsored my wife and when we sponsored her sister and guaranteed this when we had relatives from India come for a short stay. Further, our religious organization guaranteed support for the priests we're sponsoring to serve our religious community. I think this is legitimate and responsible. I am also opposed to offering green cards for people already in the U.S. if there is strong evidence that specific individuals have availed themselves for extended periods of public assistance. I am also concerned that some of the individuals who come into the country on permanent resident alien status with green card being eligible for and receiving Social Security and Medicare without working and contributing to the Social Security Fund during their stay in the U.S. Please clear up these anomalies. I believe in the concept of e pluribus unum, but I don't want serious inequity built into our socioeconomic safety net. Nobody should be entitled to get something out for their support without at some point contributing to the general fund to support the well-being of all.
Great. I really appreciate that question. I think it helps illuminate a core kind of cognitive dissonance in the reporting on this regulation. The fact is, number one, this individual is correct. As I said before, you remember filling out a sponsorship form and promising that you would provide financial support for the immigrant you were sponsoring. That hasn't changed. That's just gone from a necessary condition to and one of the only necessary conditions to one of, you know, a couple dozen other factors, and it is no longer enough to make it through the system. Now, here's the crazy thing. If you want to live in a country where undocumented immigrants are not eligible for public benefits, you already live in that country. If you want to live in a country where people who are here legally but are on temporary visas and don't have green cards yet, and you don't want them to be eligible for public benefits, guess what? They're not eligible for most federal public benefits either. Even green card holders, the vast majority of green card holders, once they get their green card, don't become eligible for any of these federal public benefits until they've been working for 5 years or have been in the country for 5 years. And the only exception to that is, number one, refugees and asylees, who, again, are not subject to this rule. And number two, military families, who we as a society have decided should become eligible for federal public benefits immediately upon receiving their green cards. So, I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, but this whole rule is premised on a deliberate misconstrual of reality. We do not have a problem in this country of immigrants, taking advantage of safety net programs they don't quote unquote deserve. Congress has already closed off most of our social safety net programs to people who don't have green cards, and even people who do have green cards, there's a waiting period. So one thing that's been highly underreported here is that the number of people who actually, are subject to this rule and eligible for federal public benefits is minuscule. It's minuscule. The major impact of this rule is imposing all of these other criteria that have nothing to do with federal public benefits or state and local public benefits on the, more than a million people seeking green cards each year. Health, wealth, English proficiency, and so on and so forth. There's never been an English test for getting a green card. This is completely manufactured, for example. So I hope that answers your question.
Thank you. Another question from Mr. Farnsworth from Salt Lake City. Will the public charge rules for legal residents wanting to become citizens be changed as well?
Good question. So this DHS public charge rule that's supposed to go into effect on Tuesday, technically this only affects people who are going through DHS for their immigration status, which means people who are already in the United States and are, either here on a temporary visa or what have you, and are trying to quote unquote adjust their status to permanent residency. Now, It so happens, we learned just this week, the State Department is going to adopt this exact same policy, also effective October 15th. So it's also going to apply to all the people who are abroad and seeking their green cards from abroad. So effectively, this is going to apply to the great majority of the 1.1 million or so people who are seeking green cards every year. It does not technically affect the next step, which is the application for naturalization, which is what green card holders can do 3 to 5 years after they get their green cards. However, you know, it affects the pipeline pretty directly. So I hope that answers your question.
So we've got a couple questions that relate to Congress and legal process. I'm just going to combine them. Angie Lewis, sole proprietors, ask, is this being challenged for its constitutionality? Andrew Neal, Northbrook, Illinois, Stritech Group president, asks, is this an executive order which could be overturned by congressional action? We have another question asking, which parties are filing these suits?
Great. Okay. So, sorry, the first question again?
Is this being challenged for its constitutionality?
So, I mean, the question about Congress was like, yes, Congress could step in and obliterate this rule. But as you may have noticed, we live in an age of divided government. So that's not going to happen. They're just going to be ruled by inertia and gridlock. So Congress is out to lunch on this. So it's really going to be resolved by the judicial branch. So these lawsuits are filed primarily by state AGs. There's also some plaintiffs who are immigrant service nonprofits, so nonprofits that provide legal services and other services to immigrants. There's many, many grounds on which they are seeking to block and ultimately eliminate this regulation. There are some constitutional arguments. There are some other technical arguments. I'd say the main argument, however, is two main arguments. Number one, that the administration has gone way beyond what Congress intended in its extremely expansive interpretation of what public charge means in the first place. You know, it's always been understood to mean someone who's truly indigent and dependent on the government to survive. It hasn't meant somebody who, like, you know, has a mortgage and asthma, for example. And the second major ground is that the government didn't follow the proper procedures for promulgating a regulation, because the rule is, quote, arbitrary and capricious, doesn't do the cost-benefit analysis properly, and so forth.
Our next question is, we've got a number of people who are in the tourism business who businesses have been affected by a drop in travel from abroad. I believe that's the next question. Laura Mandala, Alexandria, Virginia, Mandala Research CEO. How do you think this will impact inbound international travel to the U.S.? I think I'd like you to break this into two pieces. One is the simple process of getting in, and then also the desire of people to come here.
Yeah, great question. I think in terms of process, it's going to be an adverse impact. It's hard to predict how much. But like I said, the DHS rule technically doesn't apply to people who are traveling to the U.S. It's people who are already here. But the State Department rule, which is basically a clone of the DHS rule, was just announced yesterday. That is going to affect people traveling overseas. And furthermore, this public charge standard, this new expanded standard, is going to apply not only to people seeking green cards from abroad, but all travelers from abroad. So tourist visas, business travel visas, student visas. Now, will the State Department apply this these criteria, you know, exactly the same way to every single visa category? Probably not. But are you going to be more likely to get denied that tourist visa or business visa or student visa on public charge grounds starting next week? Absolutely. So I think you're going to see a lot more people getting denied at the consular office, by a consular officer, and having no ability to appeal that. So I do think it's going to have an adverse effect on travel to the United States, which is not good for us in any way. It has nothing to do with national security, by the way. And in terms of people wanting to travel to the United States, I haven't looked at the latest statistics. I know that growth in student enrollment is certainly down. I think we've seen such a change in the climate and the message we send to the rest of the world over the past 2.5 years, that that it's not surprising that that people are thinking twice about visiting the United States versus other countries.
Yeah, we've issued reports on the impact of the drop in international tourism on American businesses and on the impact on college towns, college universities, and tuition.
Right.
In-state students caused by the drop in interest from foreign students, and it's significant. I've got a question from Frank Myers. My wife and I have been a lawful immigrants and permanent residents, had jobs and owned businesses, and paid income taxes and FICA since 1968. We are now on Social Security and Medicare and want to become American citizens. Will we be turned down because we have a mortgage and credit card balances? I still work as a consultant and have an income, but as such is unpredictable.
No, your lawful permanent residence, so this doesn't apply to you because you're already lawful permanent residents. And this doesn't affect the naturalization application. However, I do want to add two footnotes here because that's a really good question and this affects you personally. Number one, it is technically true under immigration law that if you are a permanent resident and you leave the United States for more than 180 days and come back, then you're technically being readmitted in the eyes of the law. And so the DHS public charge rule could apply to you. You could show up for, you know, at the border, you know, at the airport and have a Customs and Border Patrol officer ask you about, you know, what public benefits you've used. We have no idea how often that's going to happen. There's been no guidance for CBP. It's totally chaotic, potentially. So my, you know, I'm not an attorney. I'm not giving legal advice, but I would say one of the few kind of messages that comes out loud and clear from this rule is that if it's implemented and you're a permanent resident, especially if you're using public benefits that you earn, you might want to think twice before leaving the country for more than 6 months. So that's it, footnote number one. Footnote number two is we didn't talk yet about yet another regulation that's in process and hasn't come out yet, which is going to be a public charge rule from the Department of Justice, which when it does get published, you're going to read about, because the Department of Justice has a totally different angle on this, which is to target not people applying for green cards, but people who already have green cards and threatening them with deportation if they quote-unquote become a public charge. Now, that is also going to be mostly a paper tiger because, like the gentleman who posed that question, you've been in the United States for a long time, you know, you're using public benefits, you're not actually going to be affected by this DOJ rule as directly as the headlines are going to make you think, because it has to have been you have to be on public benefits for a reason that arose before you entered the country, which I'm sure isn't the case, and is probably a rare thing to begin with. So I'm just putting that out there to say, like, we're not. This is just the beginning. This administration loves, you know, putting out executive actions that have big, scary headlines that serve the dual purpose of, you know, tricking people into thinking that immigrants are sapping public resources, and number two, scaring immigrants into thinking they're going to be dealt with in a harsh way.
One last substance question before we moved on to the brief and how people can participate. You've made points that it's hard to predict and there's red tape, but you've also made the point that the decisions are arbitrary. Is there any evidence of arbitrary decisions increasing, or is this a real risk?
Oh, definitely. I mean, look, setting aside the public charge rule, over the past 2.5 years, we've seen, and this is just hard data, you know, when it comes to, particularly when you look at H-1B, you know, high-skill work visas, denials are up, requests for evidence are up, which is basically like, you know, the government telling you they don't like your application, they think it's incomplete, you need to send in more information. You ask any immigration lawyer, they'll tell you they're getting asked for evidence and asked questions they were never asked before. So there's all kinds, and there's many lawsuits going on over that as well. So we're definitely seeing an increase in uncertainty and the arbitrariness on the part of immigration officers. What the public charge rule would do would kind of turbocharge that, because it's giving immigration officers a whole new grounds for denying people with a whole new set of evidence to look at and a really complicated 20-factor test that's inherently subjective. So, immigration adjudications are inherently subjective to some extent. It's always been that way. That's not a political statement. But under this administration, the whole arbitrariness issue has gotten worse, and the public charge rule is likely to create immense new uncertainty.
So let's talk about the brief that you're developing and how
sure.
people call and people in our network can participate.
Sure. So again, an amicus brief is means friend of the court. You've read about these things in the news. You know, very often, you know, businesses or other interested folks will, you know, prepare an amicus brief that's meant to be kind of like, you know, it's a message for the judge hearing the case that, like, you know, this group of signatories agrees with one side, and we want to let you know why we agree with one side, and we encourage you to rule for that side over the other side. So again, it's supplemental information that a judge will use when deciding what to do. So there's really no reason not to sign if you agree with everything we've been talking about today, and you don't want this rule to go into effect. It doesn't create any liability. It doesn't sign you up as party to a lawsuit. It just you know, puts you your name and your company's name on the bottom of hopefully a long list of signatories at the bottom of an amicus brief that states the four things I said earlier. In more lawyerly language, but in regular language, it'll be, you know, the public charge rule will reduce the talent pool available to U.S. employers. It will impose substantial paperwork burdens on immigrants and their employers. The costs of the rule far outweigh any benefits, and the rule is contrary to American values. That's it. It's going to be about 20, 25 pages. It will be written by a top appellate and Supreme Court advocate that Boundless is engaged for this purpose. This will cost you nothing in terms of time or money. All you have to do is just sign. And by sign, I mean, you know, fill out a Google form that we're sending around that takes about 20 seconds.
And I just want to make one point that I think deserves to be reinforced. You're not asking anybody to sign on to a legal argument. You're not asking business people to assess a legal argument at all. All they're doing is making a business judge. This brief makes business arguments in a case where those arguments are really important.
That's right. You can think of this as supporting evidence. I mean, this is about the impact of the rule. It's not based. It's not about its constitutionality. It's not about its lawfulness. I want to be careful about that. I mean, it might say somewhere in there, you know, this is lawless. But I mean, that's what the plaintiffs are arguing. So that's not such a stretch. But no, it's not committing anybody to any particularly histrionic political statement or legal argument. It's just about the adverse impacts that this rule will have on the business community.
Got it. So we're going to be emailing a link to the Google Doc to everyone on this call. We'll be emailing a link to the rest of the network. If you have any questions, if these people have any questions, where can they go to find out more?
Sure. Well, when you send that around, Jim, there will be links to a lot more information.
Great. I think that's all the time we have for now. Doug, thank you very much for joining us. Thank you very much for organizing this effort.
No, thank you.
Keep working with you. If you have any more questions, just email them to us at info@businessfwd.org. And thank you all very much for joining. We appreciate it.
Thanks, everyone. Take care.